Hello and welcome. My name is Geralyn St. Joseph. I will be your host. I am a relationship empowerment coach. Today, we're going to talk about the relationships that create our world. And the first question is, what the heck does that mean? Basically, what we're talking about are the relationships that we form from utero on up, and how those create the world around us. In other words, how we view the world, what we're putting into it, what we take from it, how we see things, that type of thing. So what are these relationships? There's two relationships that go throughout, which we will talk about once I talk about the first four. And those two relationships are going to be changing based on these other four. So let's begin. The first relationship that we have as we're growing, and this is whether you believe in pro-life, pro-choice, this is not about that. We know that children's psyches begin to develop when they're in utero, that if there is a trauma that happens in utero, that will carry through, and they can either have memories of it or different things can happen as they get older that reflect back to that trauma. That's why a couple decades ago, there was a thing called rebirthing, which was a part of psychology, where you went through, they took you back, and you went through things that occurred while you were in your mother's uterus and at your birth. So before we can have conscious memories, they would take you back to those times, and you would see what happened during those times that reflect in your present day. It could be things like a fear of loud noises. It could be something like loving a certain song. It could be any number of things. Now, as we're developing, most of this is probably at the later stages of our development in utero. So you're saying like 6, 7, 8, 9 months is when we're beginning to sense everything around us. However, while we're developing, we are part of our mother, and the umbilical cord feeds us, but it also feeds stuff back to mom. And we've discovered this, that if a mother gets sick, that the baby's somehow the bloodstream helps her fight off the sickness and things like that. I'm not a scientist, nor am I a doctor. So these are an aside, just so you have an idea of what we're talking about. So your strongest and first interaction of relationship is with your mother. That is whether your mother raised you or not, whether your mother survived your birth or not, whether you know who your mother is or not. You had experiences through her, because when we have emotional experiences, it affects us physiologically, emotionally, and spiritually. And those effects are felt by the baby also while this is going on. So if your mom was in a very high stress situation, I mean, being pregnant is a high stress situation, but being pregnant, not having a partner, or being pregnant and being with someone who's abusive is a much higher stress than being in a loving relationship and having being pregnant. So while the child is developing, whatever you're experiencing is going into that child. Whatever you're feeling and sensing is going into that baby, and it's creating a blueprint there. Can that be erased once the baby is born? It can be tempered, yes. Can it be completely erased? I don't know. That's something that I help people to do. I don't believe that it can be completely erased, but I do feel that we can temper it and use it in different ways. We could recouch it or rephrase it so that it doesn't affect us in the same way. And if we recognize what we're reacting to or what our foundation is made of, it's much easier for us to grow and become something different. So the first is your mom, hands down. Once your mom gives birth to you, Then you have your caregivers. So I group them as one, your mother and your caregivers. Now your caregivers may be your mom, it might be your dad, it might be your aunties, your grandmother, whoever it was that was around you as an infant who taught you whether or not they were reliable. So that's a big thing, because when you're an infant and you have, there's no way for you to do anything for yourself. There's no way for you to defend yourself. You are totally reliant on the people around you to take care of you. Did they feel that they could spoil a baby under 6 months old and would let you scream and cry in your crib and wouldn't check your diaper to see if it was wet? Did they not care if you were hungry because they were on a schedule and they were going to feed you every X amount of hours, whether you were hungry or not? That's when you got fed, and they were not going to allow you to judge whether you were hungry or not. Were they doting, where every little peep, they were right on top of you? It's somewhere in the middle where we develop balance. And I think that's what needs to be realized or recognized, because as we move forward, we need to realize that what we're looking for is balance. So we don't want to be so structured that the baby feels like they don't count and they can't rely on us, but we also don't want to be so unstructured that the baby feels like there's never going to be any autonomy, and there's nothing is developed, there's no resilience developed. So it's somewhere in the middle. And the way our caretakers treat us as we grow up, that helps us figure out what the world is like. Is it trustworthy? Is it not trustworthy? Does it hurt? Should I express my feelings? Do I express my needs? Am I loved more and cuddled more if I don't express my needs? What's happening here? And these are not conscious thoughts by babies and children. This is coding that is put into our, you can call it soul DNA, into our nervous systems. And this will tell us how we're going to move forward and how we're going to deal with things. So first is your parents. And then after you start going to school, then we have this whole other realm. Teachers, safeties, adults at school, I put them under the caregiver. So they're still part of that. So that carries over into the school age. So when we start school, then we start interacting with kids our own age, usually. And by doing that, then we learn how to be more autonomous. And this is where we see our training, our original training, come to pass. So are you going to be able to make friends? Are you going to be unable to make friends? Are you going to trust people? Are you trustworthy? All these things are things that we suss out as we broaden our circle from caregivers and people in authority to friends, because friends are actually closer to us as people. And that you're dealing with a peer as opposed to someone who's above you. So the people who are above you, you can't do a whole lot about. I mean, everybody's had teachers that were absolutely fantastic, that changed your world for the better. And then people have had teachers also who have crushed your dreams, or at least tried to, who were completely out of line, that you couldn't trust or that weren't good at what they did. We have to, as we move out in the world, take these different models and look at it and say, okay, what am I going to pull from here? What am I going to pull from there? Then as we move out further, we have our extended family. So you have your caregivers and then you have your extended family. Now this and friends go hand in hand. The difference is in the family structure, when you're talking about your siblings, this is lifelong. When you're talking about your cousins and your ancestry, your descendants, your ancestors, all of this is kind of baked already. So when you're introduced to a cousin or a sibling, you're around each other, but you're under the same structures, so that it's creating the same type of coding generally. So first it's you, you're in utero, you're connected to mom. Mom's a big impact. Whatever she's dealing with while she's pregnant, huge impact on you. Then you're born. Then it's your primary caregivers. Then you meet your siblings and your family, and then you go to school. And through all of this, we're learning about who we are and figuring out how we want to be in the world. Again, it's not a conscious thing. These are things that are kind of imprinted in us. It's a type of coding that we get as we get older. Every relationship carries coding with it. And we can decide whether or not to keep that coding once we recognize that it's there. Every connection we have ties us together. And again, we can decide whether we want to continue that connection or whether we want to sever it. Do we want to change it? Do we want to get rid of it completely? Is it serving us? Let's move forward. So you go from baby with your caregivers, your siblings, your family, you go to school, and then you're in high school and your hormones start raging. And oh my goodness, what is this? Then you start looking for a significant other, or most people do. When you become a teen into a young adulthood is when we start recognizing that we're looking for a mate or a companion, someone to be with all the time who's not your best friend, but someone who maybe you want to make a family with, or you want to have a family with. That's a whole nother bowl of wax. And generally, those relationships, especially in the beginning, will mimic or mirror, who do you think? Your parents, whether your parents were together or not, the way they relate to one another, the way that they relate to the opposite sex, the way they relate to their partners. If not your parents, your grandparents, but it's your caregivers, the way you see your caregivers interacting with other important caregivers, the way you see those relationships being held up, that is something that you carry with you. And again, it's not a conscious thing. So I noticed as I started having relationships that one of the things that I would do is if I would get hurt right away, like somebody would say something that like, and I would immediately clam up, close up, you're not getting any affection from me, I'm backing off, I don't trust you. And it left very little room for relationships to really grow. I recognized that a lot of that I was getting from people that I had seen that I had grown up with, not throwing anybody under the bus, who immediately reacted with anger. Anything that happened that they were uncomfortable with, immediately it was anger. Anger closing up. So it's a way to protect yourself, but it's also a way to distance yourself from a good, healthy relationship. It's not allowing for the growth. I was lucky because I saw, because we have a big, close family, I have a lot of different connections that I could pull from that I saw. And I saw members of my family whose relationships I want to emulate, whose relationships I still want to emulate because they are amazing. The discussion between the two is amazing. Like they've been together over 50 years, 60 years, and still hold hands. Things like that are awesome to see. And not everybody has that to look at as the epitome of a healthy relationship. So your significant other is often a reflection to you of what it is you need or what it is you feel you're deserving of. So we have to look at those patterns and see, what are we doing? What is happening in our romantic relationships? Are we discounting our partners? Do we feel like we're giving them a say, but we're really not giving them a say? Do we do things that we know are hurtful, like as a knee-jerk reaction? What are we doing? These are things we need to ask ourselves as we move forward. Now, I told you that there are two relationships that are throughout your life you're going to have. Those two relationships, I consider the most important relationships you can have. The first, which I'm sure you guys guessed already, is with you. Your first primary, most important relationship is with yourself. If you don't have a good relationship with yourself, it is impossible for you to have a good relationship with someone else. This is along the lines of, you can't really give love if you don't love yourself first, which is, that's partially correct, but I feel like it's much more complex than that. When you talk to yourself, how do you talk to yourself? When you've made a mistake, are you immediately berating yourself, calling yourself names? Are you cheering yourself on and say, we could do this. We just need to focus. What are you doing? If you get nothing else out of this video, the one thing I want you to get out of this video is to pay attention to the way you speak to yourself. I want you to wake up every morning, and when you first see yourself in that bathroom mirror, or a mirror in your bedroom, or wherever you have your mirror, look at yourself and say, looking good this morning, I love you, and really feel it. And if you cannot, why not? And you want to continue to move forward until you can feel it, because it is very, very important that you do feel it. That is the wellspring of the love that you bring into your life. It's the wellspring of the love you see in your life. Maybe you'll see love amongst two people, but you never feel it. Maybe somebody has loved you so much and you let them go because you just didn't feel anything. Not healthy. Not healthy. So we need to know that we are lovable. One of the things I do with my clients is when we're in meditation or we're doing different types of journeys, I like to say, you are loving, you are loved, and you are lovable. It's very important that we come to a place where we feel that, not just that we think it, but that we feel it. Because when we feel loved, when we feel lovable, when we feel loving, anything can happen. That's the seed of creation for you. Now, the other, I was going back and forth about how to discuss it. I had looked at another person's teachings, I guess I would say. I do not remember her name. I'm sorry, but she was very much biblically based. You know, everything was like God and Jesus. And what I'm going to call it is what I call it in my everyday, which is spirit, your spirituality, your spirit, the way you view the all that is, the world, whether you believe in a religion, whether you believe in the Buddha and the Buddhist teachings, whether you believe in several different gods, whatever it is that brings you comfort in those times that are darkest. That spirit. So your spirit or spirituality has to do with your faith and really having deep faith, even if it's faith in yourself, is important. It doesn't have to be faith in whoever. It can be faith in yourself and your soul and being part of the universe. You can be an atheist and just believe in, you know, intelligent design, or you might be an atheist and just believe that everything is an accident. But it's having faith and love to put out there and to use internally also. It's a healing agent, and it's what gives you a certain sense of power. So when you're in utero, you still have the self, but it's not fully formed yet. I believe, and from what I've seen, children come in with a good chunk of their personality is already there. I can tell you this because from when I was a young child, we were a foster family for infants. We would get kids directly from the hospital before they went to their foster families. And we would usually have them from like a couple days old till they were 3 to 6 months. And every single one of those kids had a personality. Every single one of them was different. Every single one of them reacted to us differently. They needed different things. Yeah, everybody needs their diaper changed. Everybody needs to be burped and fed. But some of them were very ornery. Some of them were very playful. Some of them were very cuddly. Every child was different. And if we were born clean slate, that would not be the case. They would all be exactly the same. And that's not true. So we have that little bit of who we are. And I like to believe that's our soul coming in with us. And we have a certain amount of programming that comes in with that. You have the programming that comes with being in utero and all that's getting put together. And then we grow. And as we grow, we will either be brought into a faith, like I was baptized and everything Catholic. I went to Catholic grade school and high school. We went to church every Sunday. We followed a lot of Catholicism. I still have siblings who do. So we all were brought into a faith. Not everybody has that. Some people are brought into households that have more than one faith. Some people are brought into households that don't practice a faith. Generally, a person, especially a child, will bump into it along the way, and then they figure out what it is that feels good to them or feels right to them. And that's where we find our faith. So as we're growing, our caregivers are authority. So then when we get into adulthood and we're dealing with bosses and we're dealing with police officers and we're dealing with maybe being in the military or different things like that, authority is represented by our parents and who our parents were and how we interacted with them and how they treated us. So a lot of people who have problems with authority figures, if they think about it, and if you look into their background, you'll see that oftentimes they will have had a problem with a parent, either not being heard, not being accounted for a lot of times. So they have a problem with authority because they don't trust it. There's a lack of trust there because authority did not do what it was supposed to do. And depending on exactly what happened when they were younger is going to dictate exactly what it looks like as they get older. We also, when we talk about like getting older and going into work, when we're working with individuals who are our peers, they're kind of like siblings. They're like our siblings and our friends. So how we acted and reacted to them is generally the way we act and react in work and in those types of situations. However, work tends to be a lot more structured than, say, when you're out of school on the weekends and you go roller skating or something. So because there's that structure there, it's a little bit different, and it's a little bit between the authority and the sibling relationship that you see in the workspace. And depending on how many siblings you have, you may have developed that, you know, you have an older sibling, maybe you're in the middle and you got a younger sibling that you can tease and whatnot. And that may be the way that you deal with your underlings at work. Like, where are you on the totem pole? So with all of that information, and oh my goodness, I've been talking for a long time, for like half an hour, I think, or so. We need to have an idea of like what we're feeling. We need to get into a rhythm with ourselves and who we are and tap into what's really us as opposed to what's coming in from outside. And I do teach that in a couple of different courses. And one is called Self-Empowerment, Completing the Circle. So we have something that came through. I run into people who, these days, who claim to be empaths and seem to have a list of things they feel they need more than others. This seems to be a new personality type, almost like the crystal child or indigo personalities. Let's see. It's not showing me at all. Okay. Do you have any thoughts on empath, how to actually deal with their seemingly strong emotional reactions to emotions when other people have them? Okay. So my idea, I am in the metaphysical world. When we talk about being an empath, so number one, all mammals are empaths, all mammals. We know what part of the brain it is seated in. And unless there's damage to that part of the brain or it's not fully developed, everybody's an empath. So you can look at someone or be around someone and pick up, I mean, it could be micro expressions or whatever, depending on how in tune the person is, and sense what they're feeling. And we mirror what they're feeling. We feel the same thing. They found it in monkeys. They found it in dogs. So it's not unique to people. When people are hypersensitive to what's around them, they'll say that they're empaths and they feel everything. And basically a lot of that has to do with very deep wounding. Now, I can sense everything that's around me, but I don't react to everything that's around me because I've learned how to filter, which is extremely important because if you are empathic, which is a little bit different than being an empath, if you are empathic and it's where you'll pick up on somebody's energetic a little more easily than other people do. Like I can pick up on someone's energetic, whether I see them or not. Whereas empathy comes from either hearing the story about a person or seeing them is how that activates. When you're someone like me, who's more of an intuitive, I'm a psychic intuitive, all I need is a name. You picture that person in your head and I've got it. And I can tell you what they're thinking, not what they're thinking, what they're feeling. A lot of times I can kind of suss out what their motivations are with things too, but it's more of an extrasensory gift. I think a lot of people who have anxiety and depression have jumped on the, oh, an empath bandwagon, which I know I'm gonna get creamed for this. Don't come for me. It's just something I've observed. And they need support and help to learn how to deal with all those emotions. Because what's happening is not necessarily that they're feeling what the other person is feeling. They're getting triggered by things around them. So is it an energetic assault? It can be. But when we don't know how to filter it and we don't know how to process that, that's called being triggered. And that's something that we would like to work on so that we become stronger and healthier. Now, are there times where I'm around people, I just need to walk away and kind of cleanse because it's just too much for me? Yes. But I also know that the times when it's like that are times that there's a potential for violence or something that throws me back into some traumatic event that I've had in the past. So it's more like a PTSD trigger. And I feel like if we just throw everything and say, oh, I'm just an empath and I need this and I need that and I can't be around these people and I can't do this, and don't look at what is the core, why? What do you need to feel safe? Where did that come from? Is this really a talent? Because if it's really a talent and you're an empath and that's going to be your talent, you could do great things for people. You could become a psychologist. You could do all these wonderful things and help people and comfort them because you would know exactly what they were feeling without them having to tell you. And you would know what to do because that's part of the training and part of why our empathic abilities are becoming more and more intense, I guess, as we get older and as time goes on. I've seen a lot more of it, I'd say, in the past 20 years than I did previous to that. And I feel it's because we're here to open up the hearts of people all together. And opening up the heart means being willing to feel things. And if we're willing to feel things and we recognize it in somebody else and we can feel it and we can tap into that, then we can help give them a safe space for them to be able to feel what they're feeling. I hope that answers your question. So I have mixed emotions about it. It depends on the person. But what I do see a lot is a lot of people who are very wounded, who are using the term empath instead of looking into healing their wounds and what's actually going on. So that's where that is. So once we recognize that we are formed by all these different emotions from in utero to now. And if you believe in past lives, it could be even before utero, but we're just going to start with in utero to now. And if we recognize that and we start looking at our behaviors and comparing it to, you know I do this and it's kind of mean and I don't know why I'm doing that. And then you start thinking, oh, my mom used to do that. I watched my mother do that to my father all the time. And that's what I'm doing. Once you recognize what's there, then you can do something with it. Simply recognizing what the action is a good first step, but recognizing where that was planted so you could pull it out by its roots does a lot more, because then it's a lasting change. And it's not something that you're going to have to constantly remember to do, because you're going to fall back into it whenever you're tired or stressed or whatever. You're going to change your programming. You're going to increase your operating system and you're going to do better. I think that's enough right now. Join us at Meetup. I have two groups. I have Mystery, Mystics, and Metaphysics. And I also have Coffee with Conversation for Well-Being. I try to see these two groups every other week. And we will have talks like this. Because you're not in the group, you're not going to get to listen in on the discussion that we have after we do the taping. I have lots of things you could look at for free or for fee. And right now I am doing the Metaphysics of Relationships, which is a multi-level class that will be continuing for probably a while, but each segment of it is short and small so that it's easily digestible. We're starting with pulling cords and a soul retrieval as this part, which is 6 weeks. And then the next 6 weeks, we'll be looking at things like this programming and what are our connections and how do we make the best use of our connections and which ones do we release. And we'll be getting more as we move forward, we'll get deeper and deeper into your programming so that we can help you release it and become the healthiest you that you can be. I'm Geralyn St. Joseph. My website is Relationship Coach, G as in girl, S as in Saint, J as in Joseph. RelationshipCoachGSJ.com. Thank you so much for joining me today, and meet us over on Meetup so that you can be part of the after filming discussions. Mahalo.